We're going to start this meeting. I want to welcome you out to tonight's meeting of the Northern Region Advisory Council. My name is Bryce Thurgood, chair for the Northern RAC. I represent the public at large, and I live in Perry. We'll start with John over here and do introductions around the table.
John Blazard from Camas, Utah. I'm representing agriculture.
Mike Lauder, Hooper, Utah, representing sportsmen.
Aaron Johnson, West Weber, representing sportsmen.
Chris Hoekstrom, Ogden, non-consumptive.
Matt Clark, Ogden at large.
David Earle, Beaver Dam, representing Ag.
Randy Hutchison, Ogden at large.
Kevin Oliver, BLM, West Desert District.
Paul Chase out of Logan with Forest Service.
Darren Perry, representing the Shoshone Nation.
Kristen Purdy, Ogden, non-consumptive.
Justin Oliver, West Haven, public at large.
Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
We'd also like to recognize Byron Bateman from the Wildlife Board. He's always here faithfully at our meetings. Thank him for coming. We'd also like to take a second, everybody, if you would, turn your ringers to silent so we can not have a interrupted meeting. We'll see who the first one that doesn't do it is. There's always somebody. Purpose of the Regional Advisory Committee is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy rules, and regs. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five advisory councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Please respect everyone's right to an opinion, even if it conflicts with yours. There is no need for clapping or vocal outbursts to support and criticize other comments. And we do have law enforcement in here that will take you out behind the parking lot and dispose of you. This meeting will be recorded for the transcription of the minutes. The audio recording will be available on the DWR website. When speaking, please use the microphone and speak clearly into it. The public will use the microphone located at the front center of the audience, and speakers should state their name and, if they wish, where they are from. Just really critical that we speak in it so we can record, get the recording done right. So, please take a minute to look at the agenda for tonight's meeting. Any objections to it? Okay. If not, we'll approve it. Next business is the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Does anybody have, hopefully everybody got that. I sent it out. I don't remember getting any emails back or that it went through to everybody. So if anybody has, if nobody has questions on that or concerns, we'll approve that as circulated. The next thing we have is the Wildlife Board update, and that was from, it was two weeks ago was the Wildlife Board meeting, and it was from our April meeting with the big game permit numbers and stuff. I'll run through it real quick. The rule amendment, they supported it as presented and added shotguns to that. That was the close range, or the muzzleloader bow, short range weapon season that just the rule primitive weapon, yeah. There's no season for it right now. It's just, it's in rule. That passed 6-0. The next motion on the Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime, they broke it up into, there was quite a few motions. There were 6 motions, actually. The first one was to keep Pine Valley deer numbers as the division recommended. There were some concerns down south. They wanted to reduce it, but they went with the division's recommendations. That passed 6-0. The Zion sheep, this was one that we made on ours, is to keep the tag numbers the same as last year on the rifle plus the 3 archery. So 11 rifle and 3 archery. That passed 6-0. There was a motion to decrease the Manti deer by 500. That problem on the South Manti deer not recovering, that passed 6-0. Motion to change the South cache. There was people from Logan that, when they did the elk committee, they're concerned they wanted a trophy elk unit in the northern region, in our region, and they feel like they weren't getting the South cache age objective there quick enough, so they cut the tags from 53 to 40, and that passed 4-2 on the South cache elk. The next motion was to only increase the Yellowstone deer by 100 instead of 150 in the northeast region. That passed 6-0. And the last motion is to accept the remainder as presented. That passed 6-0. The next one was the antlerless recommendations. There was a motion to add the August 1-11 on the north end of the beaver, 150 tag antlerless. We're trying to target some cow elk on the north end. That passed 4-2. A motion to increase the East Canyon to 600 instead of 1,000 that the division recommended. That passed 6-0. And a motion to accept the balance as presented, that passed 6-0. The next 3, there was a CWMU rule amendment, a CWMU antlerless permit recommendations, and the big game depredation rule amendments. All 3 of those passed unanimously. The next one was a conservation and sportsman permit rule. If you guys can remember, it's so the employees can buy them as long as they're at the public auction, and they don't have to purchase it at the 3-year average as long as it's at a live public auction, and that passed unanimously 6-0. So, and that is it for the Wildlife Board, and here's the regional update from Justin.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome out to the Regional Advisory Council meeting. Just a quick update from our region. In our aquatic section, they've been a little bit delayed on trying to do a riverside egg take on bluehead sucker on the Weber. The Weber's been running so high that they've not been able to get the equipment in and do that safely. But the hope is that those flows will diminish here in the near future and they can get back out and collect those eggs. They're also working, and I think they've about put the final touches on developing the new fish trip planner. I think they call it Go Fishing. Fishing trip planner doesn't sound right, but anyway, it's patterned off our hunt planner. They also successfully released 28,000 tiger muskie fingerlings into Pineview Reservoir, and they have plans to do about 6,000 tiger muskie into Newton Reservoir. In our wildlife section, they finished up the lek counts on sage grouse and short tail. They're currently in the process of working with the Department of Ag on domestic elk facility inspections. That's where they walk the perimeter of the fence to make sure it's ungulate proof and our wild animals can't get inside. And then the last thing they're working on is finishing up the spring deer classifications. Our outreach program has been heavily promoting a recent Habitat, Deepwater Habitat Project in Rockport Reservoir. The Habitat and Aquatic Section teamed up on that project to deploy these habitat features that are provide a lot of edge, provide a lot of nursery area for small fish, and then they go out in the reservoir, they drop them in and they sink to the bottom, and they put them in pretty tight clusters to try to improve that that deep water habitat. And then they're also working on outreach is also working on several stories and just general opportunities to promote spring and summer fishing here within the region. In our Great Salt Lake program, they're gearing up to band geese in June. The Great Salt Lake Bird Festival begins May 16th, so that's tomorrow, runs through Sunday. And then they're just doing their routine sampling on the Great Salt Lake to look at brine shrimp production. And planning has started on the new Willard Spur Wildlife Management Area. I believe they've now assembled a committee, may have already had one meeting, to develop a habitat management plan for that new wildlife management area. And in our habitat section, they're working on a pretty significant lop and scatter project on juniper up on the cache unit. And they're starting to gear up and do a fair amount of spring maintenance on our wildlife management areas, including, you know, fence maintenance and weed control and those kinds of things. Law enforcement, Matt Burgess, who's our officer in Cache Valley, recently graduated. He and his dog graduated from canine school, so we now have a canine here in the region. He's been busy. Law enforcement in general has been busy working the turkey hunts this year. There's been a lot of interest in the spring hunts. And then they've also already started up the aquatic invasive species interdiction work. We've got check stations set up at, I believe, Bear Lake and Pine View, and so that work has started a little early for this summer. So that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Okay, at this time, we've got two blue cards that don't address any of the items that we have on the agenda, but we'll let them come up and give them their 3 minutes to address the RAC, and we'll move on to that point. Yeah, we'll give them 3 minutes each. First is Jerry Woodland. Oh, sorry. No, sorry, Jerry. I didn't realize both of these were for you. So do you want to, can you address them both in 3 minutes? Both your comments?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is, but it's, I mean, it has not transplant. It has to do with bag ones.
Okay. Yeah. Jerry, go ahead.
Does it matter which one I go first?
Nope, go ahead.
Jerry Woodland from Richmond. That makes me nervous. No, that's better, isn't it? Okay, yeah, Jerry Woodland from Richmond. The one blue card has to do with wildlife harassment in the Richmond wildlife area. We have the area posted with these signage up around the unit up to the Cherry Creek ski area, and I picked this one up off the road in March. Snowplows destroyed it. The reason I was up there looking is because I had heard helicopters flying around the area, and I got my binoculars out, and I see deer and elk running all over the place. And I can't even walk up there from January 1st to the 2nd Saturday in April. And so my question is, it seemed, and I called the division in Ogden, and they said, well, they're netting some deer, tagging deer. That seemed like that would be much harder on deer than me walking up from my house into the wildlife area, because they spent all morning chasing them with helicopters, just a matter, I don't know. If anybody wants to comment about that, fine. And here's your signage. Who gets the signage?
You can just set it right there on that chair and we'll get it. But I don't know if Justin, you want to comment. I would assume that was probably the best time of the year, the most productive time of the year to do those.
Yeah, Jim, would you come up and just explain that, what we're doing with our coloring program, what we're trying to accomplish and what kind of data we're collecting?
But I can't think of any time of year when the animals are more stressed than the first part of March, frankly.
Hey, my name's Jim Christensen. I'm the Cache District Wildlife Biologist. So what we've got is we've got a deer survival study going on. We catch deer in December and in March. Well, I guess we have two different studies. We've got a survival study on adult deer and then fawns from 6 months old to adulthood. And then we've got another one, which is a neonatal fawn survival study. So we catch fawns within 3 days of birth, put collars on them, track their survival as long as we can. The March capture period is when we insert the transmitters into the does so that when they give birth, we know when and where they give the birth. On the outside looking in, it can look real bad. I fielded several calls about the helicopter over there in Richmond. That is one of those areas where we have not been able to go in for quite a while now to put radio collars on the deer. So first off, it's trying to help us get a better representation of the population across the landscape as a whole. The second part, with excluding general public from the unit, we know that the helicopter does create some stress level on the deer, but it's only a short period of time. If we were to allow public up onto the mountain, it would be a constant pressure put on those deer. After one person goes up, they go home, another person comes up, they go home, another person, and it's just constant throughout the entire winter, rather than just for a couple of hours through the winter. And so we do know that it causes some stress, but we like to limit that stress as much as possible. And through limiting that, we can increase the survival. Up to this point, we have very minimal mortality of those deer that are caught that time of year. This year, we did see some increases in mortality range-wide, strictly to malnutrition. But I guess we did lose two callers up there. One of them got stuck in a fence, and the other one was malnutrition.
All right, well, I don't know, it's hard for me to imagine that me walking up there or anybody else is going to cause anywhere near the amount of stress that helicopter does for that time during that morning. I know my 3 minutes is long gone.
Oh, and you can ask your question on the turkey if you want to.
That's fine. I know there's a turkey. It seems like there's a turkey problem in a lot of the cities around the Cache Valley, and my proposal was going to suggest that we change the turkey limit from one bearded turkey per season to something similar to what we do for pheasants, two turkeys per day, either sex.
Okay.
I don't know if that'll help, but that's easy to do. My place.
Okay. Thanks, Jerry. And I appreciate what these guys do on the WMAs, because I got one in my backyard, and I would rather have them up there for a few hours one day than have people up there 24/7, so, because it is a little sanctuary for them. So anyway, thanks for your comments on that, Jerry. We appreciate it. Moving on, the meeting will proceed as follows. A representative from the division will make presentation on the agenda item. Then we will have questions from the public. This is questions only, no comments. Then questions from the council on the presentation. Then we will take the comments from the public. If you want to comment on one of those items, fill out a blue card from the back. You're representing yourself, you get 3 minutes. If you're representing a group, you get five. Next, the council will comment on the agenda item. Then the council will make motions recommending action by the Wildlife Board on the agenda item. Deliberate those motions and vote. And if Melissa's not here, because she's the one that is the champion of this, if you wish to abstain or you have a conflict, you can voice your opposition or provide your reasoning. So I always forget. So if somebody else wants to remind us. Anyway, with that, we'll proceed as following. The first one is the wild turkey transplant Dax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the RAC. My name is Dax Mangus. I'm the Upland Game Program Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. And today I'm going to be presenting the wild turkey transplant sites. It's a five-year list. These sites will be approved for 5 years. Just a brief overview of what we'll be, let me see here, the computer's freezing on me, of what we'll be presenting is giving a brief update on the population status of wild turkeys in the state, some of the tools we use for managing wild turkeys, and trap and transplant is one of those tools we'll be focused on quite a bit, looking at these transplant release sites. And a little bit of the history and what we've done with trap and transplant for turkeys in the state. And then this proposal is also represents a transition from a written list of turkey release sites, approved turkey release sites, to a map-based resource where we have actually, you know, areas drawn on a map, digitally drawn on a map, where we identify where we would be releasing birds. And then we can go through some, look at some maps of those sites. In Utah, our current wild turkey population estimate is 25 to 35,000 birds. And I thought it would be appropriate to touch on some of the goals in our state of Utah wild turkey management plan. I think they're pretty closely, many of them are very closely related to this proposal we're discussing this evening. One of the goals is to maintain and improve wild turkey populations to habitat or social carrying capacity, to minimize human-turkey conflicts, to improve turkey hunting opportunities, to increase public appreciation of wild turkeys, and to enhance interagency cooperation. When you talk about tools for managing wild turkeys, a lot of people think about the spring hunt. And truthfully, the spring hunt is really more of a recreational opportunity. As we harvested bearded birds, so primarily males, it doesn't have as much of an impact on the population. It does provide an opportunity for folks that want to go and have a recreational opportunity to hunt turkeys. When it comes to the fall hunt, the mortality that we achieve through hunting during the fall season is much more likely to help us to reduce the population. It's more likely to be additive mortality. During the fall hunt, hunters can harvest any turkey. It doesn't have to be a bearded bird like it does in the spring. These fall hunts are targeted primarily to private lands, areas where we have some conflicts and where there's potential for need to reduce turkey numbers. We typically have longer seasons, more weapon flexibility with these fall permits to help us manage the population. While hunting is our preferred alternative, there are situations where the trap and transplant becomes the best option for us. Often you have situations where you have birds in town, in city limits, or on a golf course, somewhere where hunting isn't a good choice and isn't a good fit. And so in those type of situations, we will use the trapping. And this trapping is focused on those types of areas where we have conflicts with birds. We're not going out and trapping birds in a canyon on public land where a lot of people like to hunt. Right now we have plenty of areas where we have conflict, and so our source birds when we trap and transplant come from these areas, these areas where we have conflict. And the birds that we trap and transplant from these areas can help us to bolster existing turkey populations or to start new turkey populations in areas where our biologists have done assessments and feel like there's adequate habitat to support the birds. And those are the sites that we're discussing this evening. Just a little bit on what we've done with trapping and translocating turkeys in Utah in the last, there's a graph in the last 10 years. Well, let me go back one. So here's kind of the typical turkey trap. It's called a box trap, wire mesh panels wired together. Winter is the most effective time to trap birds. The food is scarce and hard to find, so the birds are pretty responsive if you put some bait out there. And there's a little door, and the wires on the door kind of poke in, so when the bird comes through, it's a lot harder for the bird to come back out. So it is effectively a one-way opening into the trap. The birds come in to eat the bait and get trapped, and then a technician or biologist with the Division of Wildlife will go and with a little kind of a mini shepherd's crook, grab the bird around the leg and box him up, and then we translocate the bird to one of these approved sites. Over the last 10 years, we've trapped and translocated almost 10,000 turkeys in the state of Utah. You can see there's some big peaks and valleys there in between years. Some of that is weather conditions. When we have a more severe winter, it seems to be easier to trap birds. And then I almost wonder in some of these areas where we're trapping birds, if we kind of take a lot of birds and the population dips a little bit and then the next year bounces back up. But so there's some variability, but a lot of birds trapped and transplanted over the last decade. These transplant sites are, it's something that's in state code. The Division of Wildlife is required to have approved release sites for wild turkeys that are trapped and translocated. And these sites are developed with input from regional staff, wildlife biologists, and then once approved, these sites will be valid for 5 years. And again, this year we're proposing to transition from a written list with sites. I know in one of the regions, so we have a Willow Creek drainage. That was one of our approved sites, and the Willow Creek drainage is 50 miles long and in some parts, 20 miles wide. So transitioning to a map-based resource, I think, is more transparent and is more specific about the areas that we've identified and where we're planning to release these birds that are trapped and moved. If approved, these sites will be valid from June of this year through June of 2024. And with that, I've got some maps here that show the proposed sites in the different regions. I have a map. The map shows some overlap with some of the regions, but I have a map for each of the five administrative regions in the state. On the map, you can see the yellow or goldenrod color there represents currently occupied wild turkey habitat. The polygons or the little shapes that are identified on the map areas in blue represent an augmentation, a release site where we would be releasing turkeys into an area where there are already wild turkeys. And the areas in that hot pink or fuchsia color, I never thought I'd use fuchsia in a public meeting, would represent places where it would be an introduction of turkeys into a new area where we don't currently have wild turkeys. You might notice one of the themes in the northern region. We don't have a lot of release sites in this region. The northern region and the central region make up the bulk, probably close to 90% of the turkeys that are trapped and translocated throughout the state. I think in many of the areas in this region and also in the central region, they've kind of hit that social threshold for turkeys. So I'll go through the maps here. These are also in the RAC packet that the RAC members received, and you can also find it on our webpage in the RAC and board information. Central region here. Again, the pink would be new areas, the blue existing areas, and that gold color are currently occupied wild turkey habitats. Southern, then southeastern. Northeastern. And if anyone has questions about a specific area here in this region, we've got our biologists here from the northern region that can help. I am not necessarily familiar with all the sites, specific sites in this region. And thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Dax. Any questions on the presentation from the public? Questions from the RAC?
What is the average lifespan of a turkey?
So I think most turkeys, 4 to 6 years old, is pretty old for a turkey.
If you were to have turkeys on your property, how many, I'm just speaking for ourselves, we usually see 10 to 12 toms and usually 20 jakes. And then year after year, we always keep about that same number. And I was just curious, if, do they run each other off, or how many toms do, to manage a place like that? Is there anything to do that would be wise?
Turkeys, like most upland game species, have pretty high mortality. They're typically not really long-lived, and a lot of animals are dying on an annual basis just from whether it's predators or nutrition. You know, probably one of the keys if you want to keep and hold turkeys on private property would be to plant, you know, berry-producing plants that produce berries or food source. Food's going to be key. Open water is really important, and roosting habitat, so trees for them to roost in at night.
I feel bad asking about that, knowing this gentleman here has the opposite problem.
and that's really one of the tricky things with turkey, and why some of these tools are so important to us, because different people have different levels of tolerance for turkeys, and we want to have enough tools in the tool bag and available so that we can address those differences that exist.
Any other questions? Andy. Yeah.
Just more curious than anything, is there any conflict between turkeys and grouse, forest grouse? I'm sorry, is there any conflict between turkeys and forest grouse?
You know, I don't know that I've looked at that. I think there's some overlap in look at food resources. I think there's going to be some overlap, but it seems like the turkeys usually, in the winter at least anyways, when food is the most limiting, turkeys will usually be at lower elevations than our forest grouse.
Just for the record, Jim was shaking his head no in the back, so I seen him. Any other questions? Okay. We have no comments on this, or no blue cards on this, no comments from the public on this. So back to comments and or motions.
I motion that we accept the proposal as presented.
Second.
Okay, we got a motion from Randy, second from John to accept it as presented. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. Do you feel like you got let off easy?
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dax. Next is Drew. It's all you.
Oh, okay. So my name is Drew Dittmer, and I am a native species program coordinator with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I work out of the Salt Lake office. Primarily, I work with reptiles and amphibians, also do some work with mollusks and endemic fish in the state, but this is the bulk of my work. I haven't been around all that long. I've been with the division since October of last year, and today I'm going to be presenting on what I've been working on pretty much since day one. And that is a update to our regulations and a proposed new regulations for the collection, importation, and possession of reptiles and amphibians. And this update to our regulations was developed by myself, a user group of reptile and amphibian enthusiasts, and the Attorney General's office was very involved in this process. So I think the first place to start is, who is this user group? It's a variety of backgrounds. We have university professors, we have hobbyists, people who just do this as their hobby, school teachers at all levels of public school teaching, parents, public land managers, researchers, and amateur naturalists and citizen scientists. And what all of these people have in common is a strong portion of their identity is tied to an activity known as herping. So herping is like birding in that you go out on the landscape and you look for reptiles and amphibians and you record those observations, the where, when, and what you saw. Unlike birding, though, there's another part of this activity that is called herpetoculture. Now, not everybody who goes herping also engages in herpetoculture, but many do. And so the additional activity of herpetoculture is capturing a reptile or amphibian and then bringing it home to continue those observations in captivity. So the user group formed because currently, under our present regulations, they're required to obtain a certificate of registration, or a COR, to engage in this activity. And so to collect, possess, import, or breed any species that we at the Division of Wildlife consider as controlled, they need this COR. And or they would need a variance for any species that we would categorize as prohibited. So for the people who engage in this activity, they believed, and we agree, that these are complicated and overly restrictive regulations, and they interfere with the public's ability to enjoy and engage with this group of wildlife species. Additionally, the user group pointed out that we had a long list of species that were in our prohibited category, but there are thousands of species of reptiles and amphibians across the planet that are in the pet trade, and it's impossible to maintain a list that's comprehensive for all of those. So that list will always be incomplete. So we worked with them to come up with more categorical ways to create a prohibited species list. So the recommendations that are in this presentation and that are going to come with this new regulation have several benefits to the Division of Wildlife. First and foremost, we're going to gain a new constituency group. We're going to gain these herpers, these people who engage in herping and herpetoculture, and we're going to be cooperating with them like we have been in developing this rule, but we're going to continue to cooperate with them as they issue reporting to us about what they're seeing on the landscape. So this harvest reporting is going to be tied to bag limits and a citizen science element, and this will be also tied to a permit and an education course that we're going to have instead of the certificate of registration. We're also going to move to simpler regulations. The regulation that we're presenting today is now 16 pages. The former regulation was 31 pages. And finally, this group helped us better define what a captive-born native reptile or amphibian is. Breeding these things, these species, these reptiles and amphibians in captivity is an important component of this activity. Certificates of registration, CORs, are still going to be required for a few circumstances. So native venomous reptiles, so rattlesnakes, are still going to require a certificate of registration. We're going to have a two-review process. We're going to evaluate how many people are engaging this activity and what kind of standards they're adhering to, and then we'll review and update this process in 2 years for CORs for venomous snakes. If you are deriving a significant part of your income from the sale of reptiles and amphibians, you will still need a commercial COR. And a COR is still going to be required for some scientific collecting purposes and some educational use purposes. And again, non-native venomous species, so a venomous snake that is not native to the state of Utah, is still going to require a variance. Somebody's going to have to go to the Wildlife Board to get an exception to keep that snake, that venomous species. And then I do want to emphasize that if you want to go with your kids or by yourself and capture a snake or a lizard, a frog, and take a picture of it and admire it and then let it go, that it will also absolutely be allowed without any required permitting. We still want people to engage in that activity out in the field when they're hiking around and enjoying Utah's outdoors. So this proposed regulation, I just wanted to see, put this table up to show how we stack up with our neighboring states. So there's two broad categories to consider here. The first is in that lighter color, and those are the commercial collecting activities that some states allow and some states do not allow. So we will not allow for commercial collecting of reptiles and amphibians. So capturing a wild snake, wild lizard, what have you, and immediately selling that is illegal. And we'll be closely aligned with that with Nevada, Arizona, and Colorado. New Mexico does allow commercial collecting, and Wyoming and Idaho, with various restrictions on seasons and limits and reporting. Now, for personal collection, we are moving into a permit for this, but we're still going to be amongst the more conservative states with how we are administrating this permit and this activity. So we're going to allow for personal collection of reptiles and amphibians, but we're going to require a permit for that. We will not be requiring seasons yet, but we have the ability to establish seasons with this online reporting requirement that we're going to have, and I'll get into that in a couple slides down. And we're going to have limits applied to native species of reptiles. And so we're going to be on the upper end compared to some of these other states. But all the other states on this typically have bag limits, with the exception of New Mexico and Wyoming. So the first proposed changes that I'd like to detail a little bit will be the permitting and education course process. So we're developing an education course that's in draft form right now, and it will cover the basic biology of reptiles and amphibians. It's going to, with a focus and an emphasis on reptile and amphibian diversity in the state of Utah. It's going to be roughly 15 species of amphibians and roughly 61 species of reptiles. We're going to cover safety. We have venomous species in Utah, so it's important to cover safety concerning rattlesnakes and species like the Gila monster or venomous lizard. Threats from non-native species is something we really want to emphasize in this course. We have several invasive species, invasive reptiles and amphibians in the state that are problematic, and we like to have this group increase awareness of this issue. And so we're going to cover that in addition to the issue of not releasing reptiles and amphibians once they've been brought into captivity. Even native species to the state, once they've come into captivity, they can develop diseases that, if they're ever re-released, that becomes a disease problem in the wild populations. And the only way to effectively prevent that is to never release a reptile once it's retained in captivity. Habitat conservation is going to be covered to some degree, and the regulations will be broadly covered in this education course. So once somebody takes this education course and passes a simple exam at the end, they can purchase their permit. And that will all be online. So in addition to this permit, we've developed bag limits for all of the native reptiles and amphibians in the state. So we used existing regulatory structure, and UDWR regulations have categories for limits, and those are the limited category, the standard category, and the expanded category. And that is from increasing a conservative bag limit, increasing to our most liberal bag limit. So the limited category will have 14 species of reptiles, and in that category you will be allowed 2 per species per year and 4 in total possession. The standard category will be limited to 3 per species per year and 9 per species in total possession. And the difference between those two categories, in the limited category, we worked with the user group for species that we would really like to receive the information on in the Division of Wildlife, but we also wanted to be conservative because some of these species in this category are probably more valued by the herping community. So we wanted to be conservative on that bag limit. The standard category are species that aren't as coveted or valued with the reptile and amphibian enthusiast community. So we went with a little more liberal bag limit there. And the expanded category is a little bit unique. We put 4 species of lizards in this category. These are lizards that are very, very common in Utah. So for some people who engage in this hobby, they keep snakes that only reliably eat lizards in captivity. And this gives them a chance to harvest food for their particular pet snake. This is probably the most important change that we're wanting to get through on this regulatory proposal. And so we were going to establish online reporting that will be through the same portal or app, if you will, that people will take the education course and permit. And so when somebody catches a reptile or amphibian that has a established bag limit, they will be required to report the species, the number taken of that species, the locality that they captured that species, and they're required to report that within 72 hours of taking it from the wild. So this is going to give us a stream of data that we currently don't have in our archives at the department, of where these species are and when they're active and when people are looking for them. Then this will be a really, really useful tool for us for management and conservation of the species that we're frankly a little data deficient on. And then we'll publish a guidebook, and we'll update that guidebook every 3 years, and we'll use this online reporting to see if we need to update any of those bag limits or move species into the prohibited category or establish seasons. We're also going to have a bag limit category, if you will, of non-controlled species. So these are going to be reptiles and amphibians that are not native to Utah, invasive species, things like bullfrogs and non-native turtles. These can be collected in any number, but it is illegal to release them back into the wild. And it is our strong preference that they be killed upon harvest. Not required, but it would be best if these things were eliminated as much as possible from the state. We have a category of prohibited species. There's still species that are prohibited for a variety of reasons. So one will be non-native venomous reptiles. So venomous species, cobras, exotic venomous reptiles are going to require a variance. They are prohibited, so somebody will have to approach the wildlife board to get an exception to possess that species in the state. Native venomous reptiles can be possessed with a certificate of registration, so they can apply for a certificate of registration to keep rattlesnake species that are native to Utah, and that will be reviewed by the native species section at the Salt Lake office. And we're going to do, again, a two-year review process of this COR, Crocodiles, alligators, caimans, if it looks like a crocodile, it's prohibited. We'll have a few species of prohibited amphibians. These are amphibians for which we have conservation concerns for or established conservation agreements for. This is the relic leopard frog, Arizona toad, Columbia spotted frog, and boreal toad. And we have two native reptiles that we have existing conservation agreements for and or they're threatened and endangered. And so that was the Gila monster and the Mojave Desert tortoise. And then we have species with conservation concerns can still be listed as prohibited or prohibited by area closure. So via that reporting or via other data streams for certain species, we can move any species into the prohibited category on a need basis. Propagation, we're going to propose some changes for propagation or breeding of reptiles and amphibians. And the first thing to emphasize is that local, municipal, and county ordinances still apply. So they still trump whatever our permit says you can do. So if it's illegal in your neighborhood or in your county, you cannot breed reptiles in your home. In addition to if somebody catches a male and female wild snakes from the list of species and bag limits that we have developed, they can breed that pair of individuals and they can sell the offspring from those individuals. So long as the cost of that sale does not exceed the cost of basic husbandry of their captive snakes, they can sell the captive-born offspring. If they are entering into a profitable business, that does trigger that they will need a commercial COR. We prepared a packet of this regulation. It had a briefing paper, a letter of introduction. It had a full list of all of the species that we had put in those bag limit categories that I discussed earlier. And we sent this to the Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture. Both of these agencies issued their support for the rule as written, and the Department of Health in particular really applauded the education course component. So just to summarize, we're going to move to permits instead of CORs for capture of native reptiles and amphibians and breeding of native reptiles and amphibians. And we're going to have a required online education course to buy that permit. You have to take the education course first and pass a short exam. We're going to establish or have established bag and possession limits for all native reptiles and amphibians, and we've established a mandatory reporting element for reptile and amphibian harvest to take. And again, I really want to emphasize, this is a really important cooperation between us and this group of individuals who do this in their free time. There are people, Utah residents, who go out and look for king snakes and garter snakes and certain lizard species in their free time. And now we have a way for them to report that information back to us. And that is extremely valuable. And as far as I know, we're going to be the only state that's doing this currently for reptiles and amphibians. So this is a really unique and forward-looking management strategy. Additionally, we're going to allow the sale of offspring of wild-caught reptiles and amphibians. And we're going to have non-native venomous reptiles will be prohibited or variants required. And native venomous snakes, and we're going to require a certificate of registration. So I just want to thank everyone that helped me work through this process at the Division of Wildlife Resources, especially folks in law enforcement. Rick's here. I've been in his office quite a bit talking about this and working through some issues on it. Attorney General's office was really involved, and all of my supervisors in the aquatic section of the Salt Lake office were really helpful as I worked through this process. I definitely need to thank the user group. We had several late meetings at the office. People who valued this regulatory change and really loved this process showed up to meetings that went sometimes from 6 to 9 p.m. And so they were there because they cared. And so they deserve a lot of thanks and gratitude. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Drew. I'm glad there's a name for people that go out and catch them, because I just thought they were crazy people that went and caught snakes and keep them in their house. So I'm glad you have a name for those people. So is there questions from the public on the presentation? Question? Oh, you want to come up and state your name and say it in the microphone. Thank you.
Mike?
You need well, first and last. Yeah, thank you.
Mike Hurst. I'm just wondering who oversees all that?
Me primarily. So I am the state herpetologist. So the reporting will be online. It'll all be condensed into the same data file or data source. And that will be secured. So this locality information will be kept secured in the office, but we'll use it to make our decisions.
Any questions from the RAC? Chris.
Drew, sometime prior to 2013, the RAC considered a proposal for private citizens to be able to keep venomous snakes. And during the course of the questioning, it was established that we really do not have a reliable means to survey snakes and know the status of the population. In particular, there was great concern for the midget faded rattlesnake. And also, there was also some understanding that this is quite a valuable snake. And we were in the position of not knowing the population status and still knowing that it is a very valuable snake if the snakes reproduce in captivity beyond the number established by the COR, then there's really the person who has the COR can't keep them. They can't be released out into the wild again. And it seems as though we're back to this same issue again. So what I'd like to know is, do we now know the status of the midget faded rattlesnake? Is it any less or more valuable than we knew back in 2013? And what is the impetus behind the proposal to keep this snake, any venomous snake, as a matter of fact, in captivity?
So again, for venomous snakes in general, this is going to be not an open to the public option. So if somebody wants to engage with this, they have to submit a certificate of registration and meet certain criteria that we'll develop in the office for that COR. Now, for midget faded rattlesnakes are a subspecies of the Great Basin rattlesnake. As far as like their status in Utah, great question. I don't know any rattlesnake experts that could really come to a consensus on that. Whether or not the midget faded rattlesnake is even a real and legitimate subspecies is an open question. Some states treat it and protect it as a species. I believe Wyoming is specifically protected. As far as its status in Utah, it's not specifically protected. It's a subspecies of Great Basin rattlesnake, which we have north to south, east to west, and we have at least three subspecies of Great Basin rattlesnake that occur in Utah. Midget faded would just be one. And we don't consider that a specific unit of conservation concern currently. If somebody wants to investigate midget faded rattlesnake breeding behavior and breeding culture and breed them in captivity, I'll happily entertain their COR and develop that dialogue with them.
Do we have a good handle on the status of the Great Basin rattlesnake?
Very common.
How about the commercial value of any of the species or subspecies? You know, whether or not it's actually considered a recognized subspecies.
The commercial value I couldn't comment on. I don't know if it's sold in pet stores. It certainly would be illegal for it to be sold in pet stores in Utah and most of our neighboring states, with the exception of New Mexico, possibly.
Thank you.
I got a question. You don't have to answer it. Why would anybody want to have a rat or venomous snake in their house? But you don't have to answer that.
This okay. I won't. I mean, there's lots of things that people do that we could ask questions about. But people just really like to study snakes. I mean, people get passionate about it. So.
Thanks.
So if my children are out and they catch a blow snake, garter, whatever, I don't even know what they're called. All I know is big and it stinks. Actually, the blow snake didn't stink. So they caught that. They brought it home. Begged me for the whole weekend, can we take it home? I finally said, fine. They take it home. It's in a cage one night, and they all had to, they had to clean the cage and realize this is not what we wanted to do. We may or may not have gone back and let it go. Now, I'm not able to do that, correct?
You technically weren't able to do it before.
We didn't do it. I was just hypothetically.
That part of the rule is technically not changed. So now you know. Now you can help raise awareness. I mean, so...
I didn't want to bring it home. That would have been good to tell my kids they're going to go to jail if they did.
Just for example, a reason why it should be illegal, snake fungal disease is an emerging pathogen for snakes. And you can get it in your pet snake, even just by purchasing food for that snake at the pet store. You can develop it in your own pet snake. So if you re-release it, you've now infected wild populations. That's why it's illegal. As far as, like, kids catching snakes, like, I did. That's why I'm a herpetologist here today. Like, I went out and caught snakes. It's great. I think it's really important. But it's up to us, stewards and adults and people who hunt and fish, who read these regulations, to know and understand this and explain this to our children and everyone else why it's not allowed.
Has the vice chair ever been arrested in a meeting? Just curious.
Public meeting, publicly admitted.
It's my 4-year-old. Come get her.
Okay. We have no comment. Oh, sorry, Randy.
Just a quick, because I'll admit, I didn't know most of this was regulated. But my question is, in order for you to collect your data, people have to know these regulations are there. How's the public going to be informed? What's the education campaign behind it? And
we've already issued a press release. I was interviewed by Utah Public Radio today, so we're generating awareness. It's a niche group, so the user group is made up of dozens of individuals, and that's going to be our first primary point of contact, the people who already want to do this and want to be reporting to us. So we're giving them the structure first, but then we'll work with outreach to develop, you know, press releases and social media posts that say this is a new option for people who want to buy this permit and engage in this activity.
Because I doubt Justin's the only person that
has done
that.
I grew up in Missouri. I did this, and, you know, technically it was illegal when I did it as a 11-year-old. So.
Two people have committed crimes. Let's not anymore. Nobody else admit it.
Mine was in a different state.
Okay. Kevin.
Yeah, you mentioned the community numbers. Just what's your estimate of the number of CORs and permits you think you're probably going to generate out of this?
I can't comment on how many people are going to buy permits for the bag limit species. I hope it's enough that I have to come back again and we have to, you know, renegotiate this about things. I want to see this data and I want to see this user group really brought into the fold. I hope a lot of people want to do it. It'd be really beneficial to get that group of people represented and get that particular area of wildlife some more conservation attention that it deserves. As far as the CORs, right now there's about a dozen CORs for people who keep venomous snakes. Most of those are for people who do dog aversion training. So there's, you know, to get to your question, it's not always a hobby. Sometimes it has a purpose.
My dog has been through that training. It was very helpful.
Yeah, it can be. Saves lives.
He was class valedictorian.
Quick follow-up, and then have you given any thought to sharing the data with the land management agencies as we evaluate?
Oh, absolutely. Some of our... Yeah, no question. We can do that.
No more questions. We have no comments from... You're not the public.
Mr. Chair, there was a...
Thank you.
There was a comment letter submitted today by the user group. If there's a way you could read that.
Yes, I have it. Sorry. Okay. Thank you for reminding us. It says, my name is Matt Jepson. I represent a group of stakeholders that has worked with the division to revise its reptile amphibian rule over the last year and a half. As I am unable to attend the RAC meeting tonight, I wanted to write a short letter voicing our approval support for the proposed revision. The group of stakeholder representatives is comprised of individuals with a wide array of backgrounds and perspectives, speaking with academic to naturalists to hobbyists to commercial voices. Participants who regularly interface with the division include a biologist, herpetologist from the National Park Service, a naturalist who by day is a police officer in Utah, an experienced hobbyist who is a Utah high school teacher, a biologist at Red Cliffs Desert Preserve, professor at Southern Utah University, federal environmental attorney, which is him, owners of commercial reptile businesses, and others. They represent, in turn, communicated progress and proposals to groups in the state with similar backgrounds and expertise. The group was a very balanced and informed group of stakeholder representatives. The interaction we had with the division was extremely collaborative. We didn't always agree, but we believe that the product of our collaboration is a good step in the right direction for the resources and those who interact with the reptiles and amphibians. We are especially proud to have been part of the development of a product that represents a substantial simplification of the current regs, aligned itself with the bag limit approach taken by most other states, and utilize a collection permit akin to a fishing or hunting license for most uses that is automated instead of the erroneous COR process. We believe the proposed rule will help Utah overcome its reputation in the academic world as a state where research is too difficult because of the regulatory regime, as well as the apprehension among naturalists and hobbyists to interface with the resource out of fear of accidental law breakage. In short, the proposed rule is a great step towards balancing conservation of our amazing reptiles and amphibians without overregulation. Thank you for your consideration of our comments and of the proposed rule revisions. So that was the comment we had from Matt Jepson. Any comments? So sounds like they had a pretty good group. So any comments from the rack and our motions? Drew.
I have to correct an error on her part. Great, just not subspecies of the Great Basin Rattlesnake. Subspecies of the Western
Rattlesnake. Sorry, Drew.
To correct my own error, it's a subspecies of the Western Rattlesnake. Great Basin Rattlesnake and Midget Faded are subspecies of the Western Rattlesnake. Sorry.
I'll make a motion that we accept the division's proposal as presented, with the also add that I cannot be arrested for my comments also.
No second, sorry.
I'll second. Not the last part.
Okay, we have accepted as presented. And Chris, second. Discussion on the motion. All in favor? It's unanimous.
No.
Sorry. Opposed. Sorry. Okay. I did not see you, Chris. Would you like to voice your opposition?
I'm still not comfortable with relaxing or allowing more opportunity to keep venomous reptiles.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Okay. Thanks, Drew, for enlightening us on snakes. Number 7, Gunnison Island WMA Habitat Management Plan, John Neal.
John, I didn't get a presentation for you.
Oh, you didn't?
I did not.
We get a chalkboard out with chalk and an eraser, and you can.
Oh, sweet.
He's
Just having a little trouble loading it or making it recognize my jump drive here. Okay, I just wanted to give you a little brief background on habitat management plans. They're in state, Utah state code requires the Division of Wildlife to produce management plans for each wildlife management area, or WMA, in the state. I'm not going to go through all the details here, but suffice it to say that I'm writing the wildlife management plan for the Gunnison Island WMA. A little bit about the process. After it was finished in the writing stage, it went to the Northern Region office for any comments and suggestions, then on to the Habitat Council, and it was submitted to the Governor's Office through the Resource Development Coordinating Committee, or RDCC, and open to the public for comment. We did present it to the Box Elder County Commission as a courtesy, since the RDCC process does inform the commission about the habitat management plan. I'm presenting today at the Regulatory Advisory Council, and if needed, I can present it at the Wildlife Board if you so choose. The Gunnison Island Wildlife Management Area is in the green circle up in the northern part of the Great Salt Lake here. It's located in Gunnison Bay, and that green line represents a 1 mile boundary around Gunnison Island. I also want to point out Hat Island, which I'll mention later, which is located right here, also in Box Elder County. And this green line surrounding the Great Salt Lake is called the Great Salt Lake Meander Line, and it was surveyed over a period of decades from the 1800s to the early 1900s, and that boundary represents the line of state sovereign land, anything within that line. This is just a close-up of Gunnison Island. It represents Gunnison Island, but also Cub Island, which is two little islets on the northwestern part of Gunnison Island. And I also want to mention a few other cultural features on Gunnison Island, including the triangulation station here on the northern highest point of Gunnison Island. Here is the Pelicam Station. The guano sifter shack, and down here is the weather station. So Gunnison Island WMA was formed as a result of the Pelican Management Act in 1977 by the state of Utah. It authorized the condemnation and purchase of Gunnison Island and also Hat Island, which is also a state WMA. Fee title of Gunnison Island of 153 acres was officially acquired by court decree in 1980. And lots 1 and 2, which I'll show on the next slide of section 10, is currently owned by the BLM. But under the equal footing doctrine, Gunnison and Cub Islands are considered state sovereign lands since they were within that Great Salt Lake Meander Line at the time of statehood. And by rule, administrative rule R657-15, Gunnison Island, including Cub Island and Hat Islands, are all closed to public. and it established that 1 mile buffer around Gunnison Island. Again, here the green island represents that 1 mile buffer. The orange portions of Gunnison Island here and section numbers are owned by the Division of Wildlife currently, and the lots 1 and 2 of section 10 here in yellow are BLM land. The gray area is state sovereign land or Great Salt Lake water. On the island itself, there are no freshwater or springs, and as a result of the purchase of the island from private landowners, they gained that ownership through mineral patent by harvesting bird guano, and through that 1980 court decree, they retained subsurface mineral rights to minerals. But according to the court decree, it stipulated that after 20 years of non-use of those rights or activation of those rights would be forfeit. So it's been almost 40 years now and no rights have been acted upon, so we consider those rights forfeit. The primary purpose of the Gunnison Island WMA is to protect the breeding American white pelican colony out on Gunnison. And there are other colonial nesting species and wildlife that the WMA protects. Part of our management objectives on the island are to do an annual aerial census for the American white pelicans. This photo right here is how we do it. We fly an airplane around the island, take photos of the various subcolonies, and count all the white dots. And each dot represents one breeding pair or one nest. And over the last 10 years, we've had about 10,531 breeding adults. In June and July, we also do a monthly survey. This initial count is done in May, but our July count, we focus on juvenile pelicans, and from that information, we determine a productivity of those nests, and about one in every three nests produces a fledgling. Other management we're doing out there is banding and tagging the young pelicans that can't fly yet, and we started in 2011, and so far have banded 3,640 juveniles since then, and we're trying to track where these pelicans go. In 2017, in early March, we started the Pelicam project, and we put out several camera traps and one live camera out on Gunnison Island, and we wanted to capture the behavior of the pelicans and other wildlife and see if coyotes were accessing the island. Gunnison Island is currently an island, but only because the spring runoff has raised lake levels to cover a land bridge that has developed in recent years due to low lake levels. And we're concerned about coyotes and people getting out on the island, so we put up the camera traps. The live camera that's out here and pictured here takes a photo once every 3 minutes now and is viewable on the internet by the public. There's also one other functional station, the weather station I mentioned earlier, and it requires maintenance every year, and we do that during a time when we won't disturb the pelicans. One of this lower photo here of the great blue heron was taken by one of our camera traps, as with these three lower pictures here. They were all taken at the triangulation station on the highest point of the island. Fritz Knopf did his dissertation out on Gunnison Island in the early 70s, and he had help with Val Bachman. I think many of you might know him, as he was the refuge manager for Ogden Bay WMA. They both help document the number of bird species out there, and our current list total is 120 documented bird species, with at least 10 of these nesting. National Audubon Society has designated Gunnison Bay as a global IBA, or important bird area, and to qualify, at least 1% of the global population of a species needs to be in a certain area. For pelicans, we have 12% of the breeding population in North America on Gunnison Island, and also we have 5% of the California gull population on Gunnison Island. This is a list of all the species of greatest conservation need or on the sensitive species list. Known breeders are only three species: the American white pelican, the Caspian tern has been known to breed out there in the past, and also the peregrine falcon. The last five species are mammals that could potentially be on the island. As we know, they're our quality habitat is nearby in the upland areas and could potentially reach Gunnison Island when lake levels are low and the land bridge develops. There are two known mammals on Gunnison Island, the deer mouse and the subspecies of the chiseltooth kangaroo rat. It's unique only known on Gunnison Island. There's one reptile, the common side-blotched lizard, which is here on the right. This is the kangaroo rat and the deer mouse. This is a picture of the triangulation station on Gunnison Island. This is one of our remote cameras that caught pictures of those birds. And it's a remnant of a triangulation station built by the Howard Stansberry expedition on May 8, 1850, which they used to survey the boundaries of the Great Salt Lake. There's some other cultural resources on the island. Two remnant foundations are located in Lamborn Bay, which is on the east side of Gunnison Island. Alfred Lamborn, an artist and author, tried to homestead on Gunnison Island in 1895. He built a little house and had some cisterns to collect rainwater and tried to grow grapes. At the same time, there are guano sifters out there. And the other foundation is suspected to be one of their earlier buildings. But there's also remnants of a guano sifter shack. It blew down in 1994, and the pelicans like to use it now for their home. Cold desert shrub is the main habitat on Gunnison Island. This is an early map showing vegetation types in 1976, and there are some introduced species out there like cheatgrass and Russian thistle, but this doesn't impede the pelicans and California gulls from nesting. There isn't a concern about that. Here's some photos of the island. This is Gunnison Island looking north, so Lamborn Bay, pictured here, is on the east side. This is the Northwest Bay, called Pelican Bay, which is up here. Seagull Bay is on the south. That's my next slide. So Seagull Bay is on the southwest corner of the island here, and South Bay is in the south. And here's the weather station. On the north side of the island is Phantom Bay. The main habitat concerns we have on the island are development of that land bridge, as I mentioned before. So when lake levels in the North Arm or Gunnison Bay are lower than 4,193.5 feet, that land bridge develops and is accessible to land-based predators or people. Both these photos are taken from our remote cameras since 2017, and we know they're out there. And I'll take any questions that you may have.
Questions from the public? Questions from the rack? Mike.
John, I'm still having a hard time. Where exactly is this? I've not heard of Gunnison Island.
So
if you go to your main map, yeah.
Yeah, this is
west side, north of the trestle, right?
Yeah, so west side of the railroad trestle here goes through, and it's north of that, about 8 miles on the west side of the lake.
So is that Promontory Point?
Promontory Point's here.
Okay, now I'm oriented. Okay. I thought we were on the other side, and I was thinking it was East Bear River Bay or something like that. So I got you.
Okay.
Any other questions? I guess this is just an informational item, so we just, if there's no other questions, we thank you for your information that you provided.
Well, thanks for
appreciate it.
Giving me the opportunity to present.
Okay. Okay. Now is the time we're gonna nominate a new chair. And vice chair. I'm officially done, kicked off. Sayonara. So I don't know if Justin, you want to just update who's going off and who's staying, and you want to give that quick update?
Yeah, so we have actually have four members leaving the RAC as of July 1, and the first is Chad Jensen. He was our elected official. He served one 4-year term. Bryce Thurgood, our chair, served two four-year terms. John Blazard represents agriculture, also served 2 4-year terms. And then I just recently found out about a week or so ago that Melissa Wood, our BLM representative, has moved on to a new position, and her replacement will be Emily, and I'm going to butcher this, Jensko?
Yep.
Jensko? And I understand Emily is a biologist with the BLM, if I understand correctly.
That's correct.
Yep. Okay. There is, the Division of Wildlife Resources would just like to acknowledge this this service by providing a small token of appreciation. Each one of the outgoing RAC members receives a Bronson print. I'll need to round one up for Emily. But we appreciate your service on the RAC. We know it takes a lot of extra time to prepare, takes time away from your family. There's a lot of travel involved, and you do all that for free. You don't get paid for it. And so it's part of the public process. The public process is not perfect, but this is, I believe, is as close as we can get to perfect. So we really appreciate your service here on the RAC, and we'd like to have you come up and don't forget your Bronson print, and I'd like to just give these guys a round of applause and thank them for their service.
Thank you, Justin. It's kind of a bummer deal. We don't get to come. I don't know about you, John, but I guess we always get to come back. We just get to sit out there and don't get to talk nearly as much as I do now. But I'll miss it, because it's fun to come here and meet new people, have new friends, that lifelong friends from on the RAC, the division employees. It's been a good, quick 8 years. It seems like it's gone by pretty quick. I don't know about you, John, but it's gone by pretty quick. So anyway, I'll miss being up here with you guys. So this time we're going to nominate a new chair and vote on that, correct? And then after that, we'll nominate a new vice chair and vote on that. So this time, does anybody want to nominate
a new chair? I'd like to nominate Justin Oliver as chair.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Okay, thanks, Paul. How we'll do it, if we have another nomination, we'll have a secret ballot, or if we don't have another nomination, we will accept him as the new chair. So if we have another, we'll vote on it. So do we have another nomination? Okay. All in favor of the criminal Justin being your next RAC chair? Want to raise your hand? Say aye.
Aye.
That's unanimous. Okay. Vice chair. Nomination for vice chair.
I'll nominate Mike.
Okay.
I'll second that nomination.
Thanks, Chris. Any other nominations? All in favor of Mike being the vice chair? Raise your hand. That's unanimous. Okay. Thank you for making... Aaron.
Now that they're locked in, how long do they have to do it?
2 years.
2 years.
Okay. Well, there's no other business... We will adjourn this meeting until, I think in July, Justin's saying. So anyway, this meeting's adjourned.